The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee is called to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Murphy moves approval of the minutes for March 26, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion is approved, and the meeting minutes for March 26, 2025 are adopted. First up today, we have House File 1937, Representative Ryer. And I will move that House File 1937 be laid over for possible inclusion. Just a quick housekeeping note, we do have an overflow room, as it is a very aggressive agenda today. Room 316 is the overflow room for this meeting today, and so please find your way there if you can't find a space here. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an A1 amendment.
Well, Representative Ryer, you may have an A1 amendment, but we are currently without that. As we're looking for that, Representative Ryer, would you please introduce your bill?
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, committee members. I'm glad to be here this morning to talk about House File 1937. That's the implementation of PACE, the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. I want to note that this has been a bipartisan program for a number of years. I'd like to thank my co-authors on this committee, Chair Schumacher and Chair Backer. So PACE is an integrated system of care for older adults who are eligible for nursing home care, but who wish to remain in their own homes and communities of choice. PACE provides a comprehensive range of medical and social services, including primary and specialty care, prescription drugs, physical and occupational therapies, and transportation. PACE also offers meals, social activities, and other supports that combine to help vulnerable seniors stay engaged and active in their communities. And as you'll hear later, it's widely used to provide culturally appropriate care options for seniors. So there are many reasons why PACE would be beneficial for Minnesota seniors. First, there are better health outcomes. PACE has been shown to improve health outcomes and quality of life through the services that are tailored to the individual needs of each participant. This approach can help prevent hospitalizations and nursing home placements while also allowing seniors to age in place in their own communities. Second, PACE can be cost-effective for both the state and federal government. Studies have suggested that PACE can generate cost savings compared to traditional fee-for-service Medicare and Medicaid programs. It has also been shown to provide high-quality care at a lower cost compared to Medicare Advantage plans, nursing homes, and waivers. And third, it yields higher satisfaction with care. In one example, a 2017 study published in the Journal of American Geriatric Society showed higher satisfaction among PACE participants and their family caregivers compared to those receiving care in Medicare Advantage plans. The PACE model has gained increasing attention in recent years as an innovative approach to providing comprehensive care for frail elderly individuals, particularly those with multiple chronic conditions. The expansion of PACE programs is being driven by the desire to improve the quality of life for the elderly population while also reducing healthcare costs through improved care coordination and preventive services. Now I would like to turn it over to Mr. Albright to walk through the specifics of the bill. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Albright. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, probably with the correct pronunciation of your name, and present your testimony, Mr. Albright.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Tony Albright, representing Pulhas, and on behalf of Volunteers of American National Services, looking to provide you with an overview of the bill on behalf of Representative Ryer. So as Representative Ryer alerted you to, House File 1937 is a proposal to implement a program that is already an option for older adults 55 and older in 30-plus states. Many members of this committee will remember that 2 years ago we authorized an actuarial study and stakeholder engagement process, and just recently DHS issued a request for information about the types of PACE services that might be offered in Minnesota. The bill provides the authorization and details for DHS to begin their implementation process so that services are available starting in January of 2027. And now for a bit of an overview of the bill itself. Section 1 makes technical changes to existing Medicaid law regarding older adults to remove out-of-date language on PACE. Section 2 creates the department's authority for the PACE program and defines eligible persons as someone meeting Medicaid eligibility requirements, except that PACE is available to people 55 and older. Subdivision 6 describes the commissioner's requirements for the PACE program. Subdivision 7 describes the contract requirements with PACE organizations. The commissioner will develop payment rates for PACE this summer and submit a state plan amendment for PACE by October of 2025. The PACE program will award contracts on a competitive bid basis by December 2025 and must establish operations by June of 2026. Section 3 excludes PACE from the managed care withhold. And finally, Section 4 defines managed care organizations to include the PACE program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Albright. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd now like to ask the other testifiers to come share their comments about the PACE program.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Ryer. First on the list today, we have Wayne Olson from Presbyterian Homes. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, chairs and committee. My name is Wayne Olson. I work with Presbyterian Homes and Services. We are an organization that, with other senior professionals in Minnesota, are very excited about the opportunity that PACE can bring to the state. The program has 50 years of history in other states and has shown success and high impact for frail seniors who are nursing home eligible and wanting to live at home. We and others have been engaged with DHS in exploring what PACE would look like, how it would be stood up as a program in Minnesota. There has been conversation, issue identification, aspirations for program impact, and identifications of pathways to have PACE become a reality. We and others have appreciated being at the table at this formulative time for PACE in Minnesota. As mentioned, two key foundational activities have been completed. First, the actuarial study, which will lead to a specific rate methodology, and the submission of RFIs by a number of interested parties. DHS is now working to make various decisions and provide foundation for how a program could work in Minnesota, and we stand with other organizations who are ready to provide feedback and context to have a successful program in Minnesota. PACE is a program that has flexibility to meet the needs of our increasingly diverse populations who are trying to navigate the healthcare system with a simple goal: to stay independent in their homes. It is a program which serves urban and rural settings with similar impact. The program has capacity for the ultimate level of service coordination and access, utilizing a full continuum of services in a consolidated, centralized service center. PACE has proven success in combining the best in senior health care, matching to the needs of individuals' engagement with their family unit, providing all services and having all financial responsibility for these individuals, from home health care to hospitalization and dealing with all the social determinants of health that they may face in their communities. The care is provided by CMS regulation at a payment rate less than would be expected, with a high level of satisfaction. Services are all inclusive, meeting all the needs of the senior. I would leave you with three numbers. While nursing home eligibility is required, 94% of participants in a PACE program would be expected to be living in a place they call home. Number two, family willing to recommend PACE to others stands with national statistics at 95%. Third, to support access to services in the community, it's important to have transportation, and transportation is a key part of a PACE program. An average participant receives 16 trip episodes per month in order to meet the needs and the desires that they have to remain independent in their homes. PACE is a wonderful program with 50 years of experience. It is a program our seniors in Minnesota deserve to have access to. It is a program that brings quality, efficiency, often using less staff to provide services than it would be required in a similar nursing home setting with a high level of satisfaction. I thank you for your time and your consideration, and we'd be pleased to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Nielsen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hello. Hello. My name is Eric Nielsen. I'm the Regional Vice President of PACE Operations for Volunteers of American National Services. We have been operating PACE for over 16 years and in five different states. PACE is currently offered in 33 states and the District of Columbia. PACE is serving over 82,000 participants across 184 PACE programs. The PACE industry has seen rapid growth over the last few years. This growth is brought on by more and more states recognizing the value of PACE and the value it brings as another healthcare option for their constituents. Over 90% of family caregivers in PACE would recommend PACE. Likewise, PACE participants rated their satisfaction as 4 out of 5. That, combined with the quality impacts of lower hospitalization rates, decreased rehospitalizations, reduced ER visits, and reduced nursing home admissions, states are seeing the positive impact PACE can have on their population. The states that have integrated PACE successfully have a good understanding of how and where the PACE program fits into their healthcare options. As a born and raised Minnesotan, I have seen firsthand the challenges of caring for a loved one who wanted to age in their home instead of a nursing home, and to try to fulfill that wish without our state offering a program like PACE. The financial, mental, and emotional toll that takes on not only the person, but that person's loved one is difficult. PACE is a great alternative to nursing home care while allowing people to age in their home and community with dignity and access to high quality care they deserve. 33 states have fully embraced PACE as a cost-effective, high-quality, high-satisfaction alternative to nursing home care and managed long-term care. This alternative in Minnesota is long overdue. Thank you for your time today, and I'm willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen, for your testimony today. Next on Zoom, we have John Thau, Managing Director for Bold Age PACE. Welcome to the committee, if you can hear us, and please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
This is John Thau.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your testimony.
Hi, my name is John Thau. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and honorable members. My title is Management Director for Bold Age in Fresno. I've been running the program, the PACE program, since July 1st, 2024. The particular community we serve in Fresno are the Hmong, Laos, Cambodians, and the Hispanics. And we have run the program very successful, specifically for this underserved community, for the senior and elderly. Ever since July 1st, 2024, we introduced the PACE program into the communities. Especially the community that we serve, they have never known PACE for them. Particularly, they still practice as a herbal medicine. Somehow we introduced it into the PACE program. They have been very successful with the program because the program itself represents independent living. And that way they can live and close to the community, close to the community, and close to their relatives and families. The program itself has sort of brought all under one roof, which means that they can have access to quality service to the providers, which means they can come to the center and check their blood pressure, diabetes, blood sugar, things like that. So ever since we opened the program, we have been very successful. We have enrolled from between July 1st to February 2025. We have enrolled 80 participants. And I want to share this story to you because we have 86,000 Hmong minorities currently live in the Twin City. I encourage and support this bill that ask Mr. Chairman and the honorable members to support this bill, because it's important that the senior and the elder in Twin City need to have access to these programs. And I want to share this opportunity to thank you to all of you and the rest of the members. I encourage you to support these bills, because we have some community that do not understand the quality of health care. And I want to thank you too for this opportunity. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Thau, for your testimony today. Finally, on the list of registered testimony, we have Chelsea Olson from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Olson. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thanks. My name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association for the nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford Health Plan, and UCARE. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today with our concerns regarding House File 1937. Our members are committed to serving enrollees in managed care, including those currently served in our MSHO population. Minnesota Senior Health Options, or MSHO for short, is an innovative program that Minnesota established that currently combines Medicaid, Medicare, and waivered services into one product. MSHO members are assigned a care coordinator who helps them receive seamless access to healthcare and related support services. MSHO is currently administered by DHS and 7 health plans and county-based purchasers. Unlike many other states that have instituted a PACE program, Minnesota already has the MSHO program in place that accomplishes much of what PACE aims to accomplish. If the legislature would like to continue to pursue funding a PACE program and expanding infrastructure at DHS to support it, we would recommend the state take a pilot program approach first, or potentially work the intended changes into the existing MSHO program. If the decision is made to take PACE statewide, we know that for care coordination and management to truly best benefit an enrollee, there needs to be some longevity and coverage. We would encourage the legislature to ensure that enrollees are not permitted to transition between the two different programs with a frequency that may be detrimental to the best management of their health conditions and care. We look forward to meeting with the proponents of this bill to discuss how we can best serve Minnesotans. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1937? Seeing no one, public testimony is closed. Before we begin member questions, Representative Ryer, we do not have an amendment on file for you or a record of that. We'll have to get that cleaned up in markup. If you want to speak to the intent of that, you're welcome to at this time, or we can just wait until markup to deal with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll say one sentence about it. What the amendment does, it aligns the enrollment processes for MSHO and PACE to occur concurrently so that potential participants have both programs to choose from. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair Schumacher, and for this committee. Thank you for bringing this bill to this committee, Representative. So as a former Presbyterian Homes employee and now a member of this Human Services Committee, I know how important it is for seniors to age well with dignity. My family took care of my grandmother until she passed away in our home, and we saw firsthand the power of love and the power of stability, familiarity with their surroundings, and in her final years. So House File 1937 strengthens, you know, with this program, it provides more families to have that opportunity to keep their loved ones close, cared for, and connected with community. So this is really about, you know, providing them with choice, dignity, and doing the right thing by elders. So thank you so much for bringing this bill to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Representative, are there any other questions or comments for Representative Ryer or the testifiers? Seeing none, final word, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. The potential for cost savings and improved health outcomes for participants makes PACE a promising model for providing comprehensive care for Minnesota's frailest and most vulnerable seniors in the way that best meets their needs. So I thank you for your time and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. With that, House File 1937 is laid over. Next, House File 2407, Representative Zelenskar. And I will move that House File 2407 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Zelenskar, the bill is before us. Once you're settled in, please present your bill. Oh, and I see we have amendments. But please present your bill first.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members. Happy to be back at this committee. And for those of you that were here last session, you may remember a bill where we passed a bill through an amendment to allow the right to have a minimum of one designated support person with you at all times. And so the intent was to have it for a hospital, nursing home, assisted living, disability home. And what happened after session is the language was written with the word patient, and patient is applicable in hospitals. So I had to spend time off session with Minnesota Department of Health and the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care to work through some of these parameters. So that's what this bill will be today. And then I will be offering two amendments in addition.
Very good. So we will begin with the A4 amendment. And I will move the A4 amendment. Who would like to present on the A4 amendment? Representative Zelenskar.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members. This just gets the bill in the proper language to address the issue that I just stated. In working with the Minnesota Department of Health, I also had to work with the Department of DCT, the Correction Treatment Center, with DHS. With the word resident, I had to make sure we had parameters there. So this A4 amendment inserts the language needed to make sure we have the Office of Long-Term Care and for Long-Term Care and Mental Health Disabilities stated there. We also have the language of resident choosing, and we also have the language that it would not apply to the state-operated treatment program, which has its own set of rules in subsection 253. That is the amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Zelenskar. So this amendment does get the bill in the form in which you wish to discuss it today. Okay. Are there any questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The A4 amendment is adopted. A3 next. Mm-hmm. Next, I'll move the A3 amendment. Who would like to present that amendment? Representative Zelenskar.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members. The A3 amendment is coming from the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to turn it over to them to help walk through some of the sections, and this will be added on also in this bill for the language necessary with MDH.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Autumn Baum, and I am the Assistant Legislative Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. This amendment, the A3, has four components to it, and I will describe them one at a time. The first piece is related to the case mix review. This proposal addresses changes required due to the federal shift from the old payment system to the updated patient-driven payment model for Medicare nursing facility stays. Minnesota is actually required to update its Medicaid case mix system to align with these changes, as CMS will no longer support our old system after October 1st, 2025. This proposal also includes statutory adjustments to ensure accurate reimbursement for nursing home care and services. And additionally, it mandates that facilities inform residents or their representatives in writing and before therapy begins about the impact of therapy on their case mix classification. One other piece I wanted to mention about this proposal is that it also interacts with DHS and is necessary for them to determine the daily rate the facility charges for the residents' care. So it's tied to one of their proposals as well. The second proposal that I'm going to talk about today is the Supplemental Nursing Services Agency updates. This proposal corrects a drafting error from last session regarding the frequency of MDH surveys of SNSAs. The original intent was to require surveys every 2 years, and this proposal restores the intended biennial schedule rather than the current semi-annual requirement. This bill also clarifies the definition of ownership interest for background study purposes. Currently, SNSAs must submit background studies for any owner, which can include dozens of individuals. This change defines ownership as an individual or legal entity with at least 5% equity. This proposal also MDH will continue engaging regularly with provider associations and others to ensure transparency and support implementation of these pieces. The third aspect of this amendment is related to assisted living licensure updates. This proposal includes targeted revisions to the framework under Minnesota Statute 144G. It reflects many conversations since last session and strengthens residents' protections, clarifies licensing requirements, and ensures better alignment with fire safety and life safety code standards. So some of the key provisions include requiring each assisted living facility building to have a 2-hour fire barrier between any licensed and unlicensed area of the building, establishing a mandatory 12-month waiting period after the denial of a provisional license before a new application can be submitted, clarifying that the director must be affiliated as the director of record, and aligning licensing requirements with the life safety code. The final part of this proposal is related to medication training. This proposal allows the Commissioner of Health to approve medication training programs for unlicensed personnel, expanding beyond those currently offered through Minnesota post-secondary institutions. Currently, these training programs must be approved by the Office of Higher Education and offered through a post-secondary institution. This bill would allow nursing homes and provider organizations to develop and submit their own medication training programs for MDH review and approval. This change removes a key barrier for providers or facilities providing who are facing staffing shortages. So that is a summary of the four parts of our amendment, and we are happy to answer any questions you have related to the amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Baum. Are there any questions on the A3 amendment? Representative Knorr. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on Article 2, Section 12, lines 8.17. In regards to the life safety code, can you briefly explain to us, a portion of the facility, if it's a duplex, if it's in a different setting, or even if it's one building, how will this be applied?
Ms. Baum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I'm actually going to have my colleague from the Department of Health come up and help answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Krieger. I am an assistant division director in the Health Regulation Division. Representative Knorr, can you please restate your question?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's section, Article 2, Section 12, line 817, the life safety code for the fire.
Ms. Krieger.
Sure. Mr. Chair, in regards to the question, Representative, it really is looking at how we can better define in statute what a facility is and how best a facility could potentially be utilized for other areas within the facility that are potentially unlicensed. So if we're having an assisted living building in that facility with the four walls, in that building itself is considered an assisted living facility, but looking to see how else the facility may be utilized in other areas, but we're still meeting the fire codes in regards to the 2-hour requirements in the fire code.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to request there's clarity in that process. Sometimes there's a lot of confusion in guidance. Mm-hmm. So this a little bit confuses whether it's when it's a single family home, when it's a multifamily property, or whether it's a different section of the same facility. And it adds up some cost to providers, especially small providers who may not be able to fulfill the requirement under that section. So I hope we can continue to have the conversation as we proceed. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A3 amendment is adopted. See no other amendments for House File 2407. Representative Salenzlikar, to your testifiers. As they're making their way forward, it should be announced that the overflow room in 316 will be absconded by the Catholic Conference at 9 o'clock with a group of bishops, and so if that's an issue for you, you should find other placements soon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Burnt. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative in support of House File 2407 as amended by the A4. Visitors in long-term care settings support residents' emotional well-being and reduce feelings of isolation and strengthen personal connections that are essential to quality of life. Limiting visitation as the state and federal governments required during the pandemic was shown to negatively impact a resident's mental and physical health. In fact, most public health institutions have long identified a link between social isolation and chronic illness risks. House File 2407 reinforces an assisted living resident's right to have someone of their choosing be with them for support. Similar legislation was pursued last year for other healthcare settings. The proposal applies to and is consistent with the Assisted Living Bill of Rights in 144G.91. We thank Representative Zlesnikar for bringing this forward for clarity and on a resident's right to have a designated support person. And I'll turn it over to my colleague to finish our testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert, and I am also here on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative, and I will direct my comments to the A3. So first, we are very supportive and appreciative of the Health Department for Sections 6, 7, and 17, which expand access to trained medication aid training. This language would allow the department to approve curriculum for TMA programs to be done in nursing facilities, much like our CNA, or Certified Nursing Assistant Program, operates today. We know that expanding access to training at the location where that caregiver already works and already has a relationship with the residents is an excellent way to improve quality outcomes for the resident and a professional development opportunity for caregivers. So appreciate that language being included. We are neutral on the case mix review language in sections 1 through 4. Our primary concern is really about how this transition will impact nursing facilities, especially with things like a proposed 2% operating cut. So this is more an issue for the DHS side of the table, but wanted to flag nonetheless. We have some outstanding concerns with the fire barrier language in Section 12. In addition to the conversation that Chair Noor had with MDH, we would also point out that the term constructed vertical barriers are not defined in the NFPA. Therefore, the amended language is a little bit more susceptible to variation in interpretation by the Health Department. So we would encourage stronger use of clearly defined language that is consistently applied and consistently interpreted. Finally, we do oppose the language pertaining to restraints at this time. We feel our concerns have not been sufficiently addressed in conversations with stakeholders in the department. In particular, we think that the existing language is very confusing for providers who do not intend to use restraints at all in their facilities, and there is no sufficient clarity for the use of resident-initiated devices like side rails. So we do intend to continue working with the department and stakeholders as this moves forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Hubert, for that. And just one note, the restraint language didn't make it in, so your testimony was so effective that it was gone before we even got started. Thank you for that. Next, we have Parise Rudina with the Office of Ombudsman.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Good morning, committee members. My name is Parise Rudina with the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 2407. I also want to thank Representative Zlesnikar for her work and dedication to this issue. HF 2407 establishes in statute the right of a resident in a long-term care facility, like a nursing home or an assisted living facility, to have a support person of their choosing with them when the resident desires. This right is essential for preventing isolation, improving socialization, and in many cases, ensuring the resident has all their care needs met. During the COVID-19 pandemic, visitation for residents of long-term care facilities was paused. Before effective infection control protocols were understood and in place, this was meant to support resident safety, a goal OOLTC certainly understands. However, with no support person allowed to be with the resident, social connection was lost for many of those residents. OOLTC spoke with residents and support persons who could see each other through a window but could not hold each other's hands. Many residents receive hands-on care from their support persons. This stopped as well, and without this additional care, some residents lost weight, went without showers, or lost mobility. Many residents with dementia experienced a steep and significant decline without their support person with them. And in some of the most difficult circumstances, some residents died without their support persons being able to visit. In many cases, visitation restrictions remained even as guidance from the CDC and MDH changed to allow more visitation. We appreciate Representative Zeleznikar's bill as it takes good steps forward to address these concerns and support the right of a resident to have someone with them. We also appreciate the A4 that clarifies when a resident can have a support person with them, reduces subjectivity in limiting a support person's presence, and recognizes our office as a helpful resource to turn to, along with the facility and OMHDD, to ensure the right is honored. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2407 as amended? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members? Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Speaker.
Ooh. Not in this century.
Ooh, I don't think we want that.
I don't think he wants to.
I'm quite content with where I am.
We can tell. Mr. Chair, members, so I'm just going to give a little story that happened and why I think this bill is so important. So June 23rd, 2020, I'm on the golf course where most people should be. Not on June 23rd, 2020, but anytime they can get on a golf course, okay? So anyway, it was league night, and so I'm pre-playing before we do league to make sure my game is good when I do the league, but it never happens, okay? I usually play worse. Anyway, the owner of the golf course's wife, she's owner too, had mentioned that her sister was in the hospital and dying of sepsis, and family members could not get in to see her. And it was just one of those things, right? Family wanted to see their loved one who was going to pass away. And after league, I'm sitting around the table with a bunch of the golfers and the owners. When the sister's name was brought up again, we're asking, how's she doing? And I ended up contacting a lobbyist just to see if they could get in to see their loved one so that the grandma could at least see the grandkids, the children, to say goodbye. And the lobbyist was able to pull some strings, and the family was able to spend 10 minutes with their loved one. And she was dying, like on the way out, dying. It took that 10 minutes of the hand touching and the talking in person to turn the life around of this loved one who is still alive today. All because of that human connection and that touch. And so I think this bill is extremely important. I had access to a lobbyist. The regular people don't have access to a lobbyist to make a phone call to see if they can get in to see their loved one. And it's not fair that this person is alive because she had access to me and others did not have that and ended up passing without so much as a I love you in person or being able to touch their person's hand as they're on their way out. So that's my story. I hope we can support this.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Any other questions or comments for the bill author? Final word, Representative Lenslikar.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And members, thank you for letting me present this. I wasn't expecting to have to do a new bill, but this is really, really important. So important that I got emails asking for, you know, clarity after the bill passed and didn't realize that we'd have issues, but this cleans it up. And I think what's important to remember that while right now we are in a state right now where people can visit people, but we don't know if there'll be a pandemic. You can't plan for emergencies. You can't plan for situations. But one thing I do know is mental health is as important as physical health. Having had 8 surgeries with breast cancer and nearly died from sepsis twice, blood clots twice, bleeding internally more than I can count, I had my family with me. But I saw all too often my cousin's son had a brain tumor during the pandemic, and these families were deeply affected by not being able to be with their children, with their spouses, with their parents dying and aging. I saw it. I slept on the units for weeks that became months, that became years. And saying goodbye for people and having 95-year-old seniors crying as their hands are on a window and their children were outside that were 70 years old crying, and all I could see is frozen tears, and I'm on the inside. It was something that I wish I could get out of my mind, but I can't, because I had to explain to a 95-year-old woman why, or a man, why their kids, what they did that was so wrong that their children would not come in, that they would choose to stand in a snowbank than to come in. They did not understand it, and I couldn't explain it. So this is for all of us. If we have cancer, if we have a car accident, if we are saying goodbye to people that matter to us, our friends, our family, there is nothing more important than being present. We have a 40% increase in mental health, and this bill gives the most fundamental human right, connections, the ability to happen in all times. And so I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Zelenslikar. With that, House File 2407, as amended, is laid over. Next, members, we're going to go a little bit out of order to accommodate the people who don't normally stay in this committee and bring up House File 1840, Representative Altendorf. As she makes her way forward, I will move that House File 1840 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you, members. This bill is a little bit of a cleanup bill with some unintended consequences that happened after we passed the Felons Able to Vote. What happened is there's just a few instances where they have served their sentencing and they were felons, but they are still civilly committed because they are deemed to be sexually psychopath personalities. And what this bill simply does is it addresses that these people will vote in the district in the county of which their home resides. So the bottom line is these are individuals who were charged. They are still being held in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program because they're deemed to be unsafe for that area. And this is also very much like the bill, which was, I'm sorry, it was HF 4043, which was Representative Agbaji's bill. It's the same principles that they would then vote in the county that they came from.
All right, thank you for that. Looks like we have one testifier today, Mr. Hollis. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Schumacher and members of the committee. My name is Mark Hollis, and I'm here as a concerned resident of the city of Moose Lake in Carlton County. I am speaking here today as an American in Minnesota to advocate for the importance of allowing civilly committed individuals to vote from their home county where they have deep-rooted ties and connections. This request stems from the core principles of democracy, individual rights, and the need for inclusive civic engagement. For those of you who might not know, civil commitment refers to the legal process by which individuals are placed in treatment, mental health, chemical dependency, or similar facility due to a court ruling. Voting is a personal and civic responsibility. For civilly committed individuals, casting their ballots in their home county provides them with a sense of connection to their community. Many of these individuals have previously lived in the county where they were committed, have family ties, and are deeply familiar with local issues, candidates, and priorities. All citizens, regardless of their mental health status, should have equal access to their voting rights. Denying civilly committed individuals the opportunity to vote from their home county disproportionately affects their ability to participate in the democratic processes. Now, as a resident of the city of Moose Lake, I must explain how allowing civilly committed individuals to vote in elections for the city of Moose Lake, Carlton County, and District 7A, just on the location they are committed, is a problem. There could be up to 500 individuals committed to the Moose Lake facility. Currently, only two of those civilly committed were committed from Carlton County. 500 votes in a federal or state election is a drop of water in the ocean. In a small county or town, 500 votes are a large number. The city of Moose Lake has approximately 3,000 residents. Imagine how 500 votes could sway the results of city officials or school board. The election before the most recent, our district representative was elected by just over 400 votes. If those civilly committed were to cooperate on their votes and vote together, the results would have come out totally different. It is honestly possible for those civilly committed to coordinate in a write-in campaign and get civilly committed individuals elected to local offices. I feel it is just wrong for all the other counties to commit people with mental illness to Carlton County and expect them to be able to vote in our county and town. I encourage you to consider my testimony with open minds and consideration of how things are currently done could affect my local community. I will leave you with one final thought. Imagine that a potentially violent, civilly committed individual was to get elected to our school board and was brought into the school in restraints and escorted by two security personnel. Now that is a picture I hope no child should ever have to see. Thank you for considering what I have testified on today.
Thank you, Mr. Hollis, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1840? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions. All right, final word, Representative Altendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did have one other testifier, and he was online, but he had to drop off. And just to let you know, in Moose Lake for the mayor election 2024, it was deemed that the civilly committed people did swing the mayor race in Moose Lake. And so that's why we just think it's important. The people that are civilly committed, again, this is a high level. They're deemed to be unsafe for the society. They're not participating in anything locally. And yet they are making local decisions. And so we just appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. With that, House File 1840 is laid over. Next is House File 257, Representative Hansen. And as she makes her way forward, I'll move that House File 257 is to be laid over. We have the bill before us, Representative Hansen. When you are ready, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. I miss you guys. I'm grateful to be here today. Nice to visit. House File 257 would require counties to speak with or meet with service participants and or their legal representatives within 10 days of issuing a notice of action that suspends, denies, reduces, or terminates the person's long-term supports and services, such as brain injury waivers, CADI waivers, CDCS services, elderly waivers, DD waivers, and PCA services. Currently, service participants receive a notice of action, which is a 9-page form that's pretty difficult to understand, and it's normally only provided in English. A copy of this notice is in your packet, so I invite you to take a peek at that while we talk here. This document lets a participant know that their services will be reduced or terminated, and it's pretty difficult to understand. It covers all of the programs that we talked about, but not just the program that that participant is in, adding to the confusion. Oftentimes, a notice of action is sent because of a misunderstanding, an error, or a lack of documentation, all issues that could be easily resolved without the burden of a hearing. Unfortunately, many people with disabilities and people using these services and their families and care teams are not getting phone calls back when they call, and they're not receiving calls in a timely manner, if getting those callbacks at all. Some counties have instituted policies that prevent or restrict case managers from discussing these issues once an appeal has been filed. This results in costly hearings that require county staff to prepare appeal summaries and go to these hearings. The participants must wait weeks for a hearing and then wait months for a decision after that, all while worried about whether or not they will continue to receive the services they need to remain independent and meet their basic needs. So House File 257 would eliminate those hearings for issues that could be resolved in a more cost-efficient way with an earlier intervention and a more person-centered intervention as well. People should not have to worry about whether their services and supports will continue or not, especially for months on end. So following this notice, once they get that, they can appeal within 30 days, but if the participant knows to appeal within 10 days, they can continue those services without interruption until the judge makes a decision. But if they don't know that they can appeal or don't appeal within those 10 days, their services are reduced or terminated until the judge makes a decision. These appeal rights are listed in the form on page 7, so not right at the beginning. That would make it really easy to find. And again, they're only in English. There is a non-English phone number that you'll find on page 9, deeper into the packet. So some will say that these explanations are already being provided, but I will tell you that it is not consistent across all counties. Of course, appeals are costly, and the time is intensive for our county staff. And while we all agree that the best practice is to provide a full explanation of any service change prior to that notice being sent, I would argue that it is more costly, both morally and financially, to let services lapse when they don't need to. Some say that these conversations that this bill would require have already occurred with the participant. Typically, when clients voice concerns at this point, their argument is that it's not that they don't understand, it's that they don't agree, meaning that this appeal is appropriate and necessary. But I would also argue that if this is happening in practice, and if this were true, I wouldn't be before you today, nor would the Disability Law Center be taking on as many cases as they are to assist people, and noticing that these are quick, and these could have been resolved with a quick meeting or a phone call. So there's global agreement that these forms are confusing. There's global agreement that it should be available in multiple languages. And we all recognize that the number of these cases are increasing. So if we all agree that there's an issue, I hope we can all agree that we should fix it too. So I'm going to give you a quick story. It's in your handout here. So a DLC client is a child with Down syndrome. They received a notice of action indicating that the county had reduced PCA services from 5 hours a day to 30 minutes a day. And the reason for the reduction was not explained in this particular notice of action. DLC and the child's parents contacted the county, but multiple phone calls left unreturned. DLC submitted letters from the child's therapist and doctor attesting that the child's needs had not changed, and the county did not acknowledge those letters. The case proceeded to a hearing, and the judge ruled in favor of the child, and the PCA hours were restored. If you ask me, that is an issue that could have been resolved with a phone call. So, of course, this is not the preferred outcome for anyone, and we all know mistakes happen, and we all know everyone is working as hard as they can in an understaffed and overburdened county system right now. They have high caseloads and high burnout. But this can be true at the same time as the need for change. And I wouldn't be here, like I said, if things were going well enough to not raise an alarm for this committee. So while much of my work here in the legislature has been to remove barriers that we're seeing to increase the workforce, protect and grow that workforce of the caring people in our state at the counties who deliver these and manage these services to people with disabilities, the reality is that these huge caseloads and high burnout with licensing boards who are inventing ideas that stifle growth of professions, complex management layers at counties, high education costs, outdated IT systems, none of that is helping our situation right now. And while we work on all of those other things, I really felt it was important to get this bill before you and to highlight this issue so that you had an opportunity to decide with us what was the best next step. And with that, Chair, I will turn it back to you on my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill into the form that you would like. No, that's on me, Representative Hansen. Any questions to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Next, we have public testimony, starting with Ellen Smart. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Neuer, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Smart, and I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid of the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning in support of House File 257. For counties who return phone calls and have client-centered practices, this will not be a major departure from the status quo. However, for counties who do not, this is a much-needed change. I'd like to share another example from the Disability Law Center's work that illustrates the time and money wasted on appeals when counties refuse to speak to clients and acknowledge that sometimes mistakes are made. There are additional examples in the letter that we submitted this morning. A client called the Disability Law Center because she needed night supervision to remain in her home and remain independent. She received a notice of action that denied night supervision because there was not an immediate safety need. But that's not a standard that appears in any DH manual or in statute. So Disability Law Center attorney called and emailed the county numerous times and pointed out the error. Never received a call back, nothing. Finally, the attorney received an email that said the county, quote, preferred to wait for the hearing. At the hearing, the county acknowledged the error and the client received night supervision. Had the county simply returned a phone call, the hearing could have been avoided, the client would have received the services, all of that could have just been avoided. So as Representative Hansen stated, to get the ball rolling, the notice of action is sent and the client has to appeal within 10 days to avoid the reduction or termination of services. And so imagine getting that notice in the mail, not understanding it, not understanding your appeal rights, having 10 days, you call the agency that issued it because you're confused, you call multiple times, your 10-day clock is ticking, and nobody calls you back. Imagine how panicked you might feel. So this is just, it's needless panic. So this bill would make counties actually respond to clients and try to avoid some of these needless appeals. So this bill would ensure that counties do return those calls, meet with clients, avoid unnecessary appeals, and allow clients to not have to worry for months about continuing to receive essential services and supports they need to live independently, interact with their communities, and perform activities of daily living when just a simple misunderstanding or clearing up a mistake, having a simple conversation would clear up that issue. Last but not least, and especially important this session, with the DE amendment, there should not be a fiscal note associated with this bill because there are no state costs involved. Thank you for your time today, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for authoring this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Smart. Next, Jillian Nelson.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, Policy Director at the Autism Society of Minnesota, and I'm here to ask for your support for House File 257. I was here yesterday talking to you about MAPD. I went home after working a full day And once again, I was warmly greeted by a service denial, dated 2 weeks ago, so not even within that 10-day window. They lost my paperwork I had sent by email, and now I have to appeal to get care for chronic pain. As I filed the appeal, I left, knowing I was headed back here today to talk about this bill. If you've been here a while, you've heard me say that how our system runs is the biggest perpetuator of fraud, waste, and abuse. The not denial and appeal system is one of the biggest perpetuators of waste. Hearings cost money. In 2021, just 6 months after qualifying for services, I had to file my first appeal in my very first PCA assessment. I lost 30% of my services in one swift move, and when I got the reduction, I wasn't surprised. I had seen the public health nurse form. She wrote down the wrong meds, the wrong diagnoses, and half of my needs were not written on that form. And there was no way for me to correct any of it except appealing. When we went in front of the judge and I told him that all of my information was wrong, he told me he doesn't like to think of things as right or wrong. There's usually a gray area. And I only got back half of my PCA hours, even though my needs had not changed. Since then, I've averaged 2 to 4 appeals a year due to errors. And I show up a statute that you guys have written, and the judges rule in my favor. And we waste a lot of time, and we waste a lot of money. I wish my story was a one-off, but I hear from families all the time about things that are denied that shouldn't. My own mentor regularly has to appeal the care on her son's plan that has been the same for 10 years. And year after year, she appeals, and each time the judge rules in her favor. The current denial process with no ability to communicate creates a burden on the system, wasteful hearings that cost state money, and trauma and hardship to the people using the system. We aren't asking for every request to be automatically approved, but we would like to have conversations, correct errors, resend forms that magically went missing, and reduce the fiscal impact of these hearings. This is common sense legislation. And a phone call from case managers is not a catastrophic burden. It's their job, in fact. Their entire job is to make sure that we have the things we need and to advocate for us, not create power dynamics by blindly denying services and supports. This bill is a huge move in both saving Medicaid dollars and also making our services more accessible at the same time. So I thank you for your support of House File 257.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 257? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions for Representative Hansen of the testifiers. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Hansen. Great to see you in the committee again, and glad to know you're still working in this area. I just want to say thank you for continuing your work in this area and specifically for this bill. Ms. Nelson was just here. We just had this conversation about termination of services and how just how harmful and disruptive it is to folks who are already dealing with a variety of obstacles just to live everyday life, right? And so thank you. I hope that this is something that we can pass this year. Thank you for taking the time to come and share your stories.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions or comments for the bill author or the testifiers? Final word, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this. And again, thank you, Chair Schumacher, for scheduling this today. I really do appreciate the time and for taking time to hear about this issue. As far as I know, this is the only proposal on the table to address this. I could be wrong, so please, I am ready to stand corrected if that's the case. But when we have a proposed solution on the table, if there's anything better, I'm all ears to hear about it. But families and people with disabilities don't deserve more complex processes than they already have to navigate, especially in a time and a world that's constantly showing them that their needs and their rights are difficult, complex, burdensome, or unfixable. And I hope that this small solution could at least be a flicker of light and hope in a time that feels like too many of us with disabilities like an era of hopelessness erasure in the simple pursuit of a dignified life. So thank you again for hearing this.
Thank you. And with that, House File 257, as amended, is laid over. Next on the agenda, Representative Vernig, House File 1678. Representative moves that House Representative Vernig moves that House File 1678 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is before us. Representative Vernig, when you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and committee members. Before you today is House File 1678, a bipartisan bill. Thank you. I'll thank those in the room today, Representative Nadeau, Curran, Norris, and Chair Schumacher. This bill strengthens Minnesota's support for family caregivers and the people they care for. It makes important investments and updates to the Essential Community Supports Program and expands access to respite care services across the state. Last year, a constituent of mine shared their deeply personal experience caring for a spouse who was showing signs of dementia. As their partner's needs increased, they took on more and more responsibility, helping with activities of daily living, managing agitation and sleepless nights, and trying to navigate the hospice care system when their spouse's condition declined rapidly. Ultimately, they cared for their spouse at home until the very end, finding a hospice placement near home on such short notice almost impossible. This story is not unique. Every day across Minnesota, thousands of families are quietly doing the work, providing unpaid, around-the-clock care to loved ones while struggling to balance their own health, employment, and well-being. The Essential Community Supports Program was designed to provide community-based services for people who do not meet nursing facility level of care, but still need help to live safely and with dignity at home. Currently, the program is limited to Minnesotans over the age of 65 with significant financial and functional limitations. House File 1678 makes meaningful changes to expand this program and better support caregivers. Specifically, the bill does four things. It expands eligibility to include people over age 60 and people with dementia, regardless of age, adds respite care to the list of services covered by the program, ensuring caregivers can access much-needed breaks from their duties, simplifies financial eligibility so that individuals with household incomes up to 400% of the federal poverty level are eligible, making this program more accessible and easier to navigate, and provides ongoing base funding of $4 million in the fiscal year 26-27 for respite care grants, which were previously funded with one-time money in the last biennium. These investments will help people stay in their homes and communities longer, reduce the strain on family caregivers, and delay or avoid far more expensive care options like nursing homes or hospitalizations. Here with me today is Robert Freeman, and we have a testifier online, Tuesday Glover, and they'll be able to speak to the importance of this support and the difference it'll make for caregivers and families.
Mr. Freeman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Co-chairs, Schumacher, Knorr, and Knorr, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1678, bipartisan legislation to support dementia caregivers. My name is Robert Freeman. I am the Vice President of Public Policy for the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Our mission is to end Alzheimer's and all other dementia by accelerating global research, driving risk reduction and early detection, and maximizing quality care and support for families impacted by dementia. And that last part of the mission is why we're here today. Across Minnesota, more than 100,000 people are living with Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia, and over 164,000 unpaid family caregivers are providing them with care. These caregivers dedicate countless hours, often at great personal, emotional, and financial cost to support their loved ones. Two-thirds of caregivers are women, and often in their prime earning years. Respite care is a lifeline for these families, providing much-needed relief so they can rest, attend to their own health, and continue providing care at home for as long as possible. Many providers struggle with workforce shortages and financial constraints, limiting the availability of services, particularly in rural areas. House File 1678 takes an important step in addressing these gaps by establishing $4 million in competitive grant funding for respite care providers, continuing a successful program that was enacted in the last biennium. Included in the packets is a list of community organizations that previously received funding, and one of them is going to testify later. Investing in respite care is not just compassionate and caregivers is not just compassionate, it's also financially responsible. By supporting caregivers and preventing burnout, respite helps lay costly nursing home placements and reduces reliance on Medicaid-funded long-term care. The number one reason somebody ends up in long-term care is because their caregiver can no longer care for them. Strengthening our respite care system ultimately benefits families, communities, and the state's budget. I also want to draw your attention to the other part of this bill, the much longer part of this bill, the changes to expand the Essential Community Supports Program that Representative Vernick outlined. This is a program that helps offset caregiving costs for care individuals, but you have to be close to poverty to be eligible, including your assets, and we understand less than 150 people are using it statewide. We think it would be a more useful program if we made more people eligible, and we're working with DHS currently on technical assistance to understand how feasible that might be. So for now, that's placeholder language. But we urge your support for House File 1678 to ensure that Minnesota's caregivers have access to the respite services they need to continue caring for their loved ones at home. Thank you for your time and for all that you are doing to help families impacted by dementia, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Next, Tuesday Glover. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Tuesday Glover. Good morning, everyone. My name is Tuesday Glover, and I'm the director of the Culturally Responsive Caregiver Support and Dementia. Frontiers of America is a nonprofit health and human service organization committed to serving people in need, strengthening families, and building communities. For 125 years, Volunteers of America has offered a comprehensive range of innovative services and networks that respond to and evolves with the needs of our community, pursuit of its mission to help people build hope, resilience, and well-being. Our culturally responsive caregiver support and dementia services team has historically focused, on supporting African American and East African community members through educating, relating to dementia, offering memory screens, and supporting caregivers. The stress, health, impact, and costs associated with the long journey of caring for someone impacted by dementia often creates two or more people who are in desperate need of support. Our work supporting caregivers reveals that the importance and the impact it offers, and we offer respite care. Dementia is a fatal disease. This vicious disease can affect memory, executive functioning, day-to-day living, and decision-making. Those impacted by the disease will eventually forget their loved ones' names, forget they are who they are, and forget to eat. They will need a caregiver. The caregiver journey can be very stressful, and self-care is vital. Studies show that the caregiver are more than twice as likely to experience depression when compared to non-caregivers. Self-care is essential for caregivers, yet the time for caring for oneself is often unavailable as a caregiver. Speaking on behalf of our clients, caregivers, and respite in a crisis, as a part of our self-care, our clients are seeking respite services so that they are able to go to the doctor or go to an appointment or even just go get their hair cut. The cost of respite is on an average of $30 to $40 an hour with a 3-hour minimum, which is often unaffordable for the caregivers that we serve. Most of our caregivers are retired and did not plan on the financial cost of respite services. The Culturally Responsive Caregiver Support and Dementia Services Program has recently collaborated with the Volunteers of America's, our volunteer program, called AmeriCorps Seniors, to recruit volunteers to assist with short-term respite our present clients so they can have respite services while the caregiver enjoys our dementia and brain health education events and classes. I ask that the state of Minnesota support Senate to continue funding the caregivers who care for older adults with dementia in their homes. Again, thank you for allowing me to advocate on behalf of caregivers, volunteers of America, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Culturally Responsive Caregiver Support and Dementia Services Team. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Glover. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1678? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members for Representative Vernig or the testifiers? Final word, Representative Vernig.
Thank you. I renew my motion that House File 1678 be laid over for possible inclusion. I appreciate your time. This is about ensuring that Minnesotans who are caring for loved ones at home have the support they need to continue doing safely and sustainably. It's a smart, compassionate investment in families and communities. I appreciate your consideration and respectfully ask for your support.
With that, House File 1678 is laid over. Next, House File 1477, Representative Nadeau. And I will move that House File 1477 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Nadeau, as you get settled in, whenever you're ready, please present your bill.
There's an amendment for this bill, too.
Yes, we have the A2 amendment. I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Nadeau, to your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Just to the amendment, or should I introduce the bill with as amended?
Representative Nadeau, just give us a brief overview of the amendment. We'll adopt the amendment to get the bill into the form, assuming we will adopt the bill to get to the form you want to speak to, and then present your bill.
The amendment clarifies that we're talking about both 144G and 245A and D, residential facilities and assisted living facilities in communities.
Are there any questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment A2 is adopted. Representative Nadeau, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, thank you for hearing House File 1477 as amended. This bill is trying to reestablish a connection with one of our most important community partners that we lost with the action taken last session regarding rental licensure with assisted living or residential facilities in their communities. I'm attempting to build on and move past the situation that created last year's rigid response to one city's situation and make our municipalities strong and active partners, ensuring that people living with disabilities are integrated in communities and neighborhoods of their choice. The complexity and the number of partners makes this incredibly difficult, but I want to make sure that we don't lose sight of the purpose of community-based settings by only focusing solely on the provision. This issue has strong advocates for individuals, for small providers, for large providers. There's guardians, conservators, people who've lost their civil rights. There's also two state agencies, numerous counties, hundreds of cities, and a massive number of direct service providers who all work together to serve this important and vulnerable population. We have different licenses for similar-looking facilities from different agencies, and even some services that are licensed by one agency in facilities licensed by another. I believe in the value and importance of person-centered approach to community-based settings and services, and every testifier we're going to hear from today wants our system to work well. First, this bill incorporates and evenly applies the specificity of residential programs to assisted living facilities, treating them the same. Second, it requires municipalities to apply rental licensure equally and further stipulates that local laws may not exclude assisted living or residential facilities. Third, it provides municipalities an avenue and an ability to file a complaint with the respective commissioner and 10 days to start an appropriate response. But with so many conflicting interests, it's been a challenge. I believe we're moving in the right direction, and now I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers.
All right, and Representative Nadeau, let's start with the testifiers that you have lined up for this, and then we'll take the testifiers who have concerns on your bill. So if you'd like to please introduce them, and then they can introduce themselves and present their testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee for having us. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for the support on this. My name is Hollis Winston. I'm mayor of the wonderful city of Brooklyn Park. I'm here not just representing Brooklyn Park today, but also our partner cities of Golden Valley, Brooklyn Center, Robbinsdale, New Hope, and Crystal. And I would also like to note the additional letters of support from Bloomington, Fridley, Maple Grove, and St. Anthony Village in support of this legislation addressing the state of congregate care facilities. Based on the firsthand knowledge from our inspectors, firefighters, police officers, and mental health professionals, we have significant concerns with the well-being of our residents that live in some of these facilities. And Police Chief Mark Bully, Detective Samantha Brown, and Inspections and Environmental Health Manager Jason Newby will get into those details shortly. Beyond the life safety issues, we are also significantly concerned with the over-concentration of congregate care facilities in our community and the related impacts. I think we all understand the value of congregate care facilities, not only to individuals, not only to families, but to society. We know they provide valuable services and a place to call home for many of our most vulnerable in the community. Ensuring the health and safety of the patients and residents, both in terms of the property itself and the care they provide, is of the utmost importance to us and our coalition. But the reality that we are dealing with is, in 2019, our city had 129 congregate care facilities licensed by DHS and MDH in Brooklyn Park. As of late 2024, that number was over 400. That is a 142% increase, or stated another way, we have added over 50 congregate care facilities per year in Brooklyn Park for each of the last 5 years. That is not something that we can sustain. However, we expect that trend to continue. This influx has created a tremendous burden on our public safety resources. While the percentage of congregate care facilities in our community is 1.7% of all housing units, nearly 1 in 10% of our police and fire calls go to these facilities. In Robbinsdale and Brooklyn Center, more than 10% of their police and fire calls go to congregate care facilities. This is simply not sustainable, and the influx of congregate care facilities has significantly strained our public safety staff and put a significant financial burden on the taxpayers of Brooklyn Park and some of our surrounding cities. Our city has a very modest tax base in comparison to other large suburban communities such as Plymouth and Bloomington, and our public safety budget has grown in recent years because of this demand, and today constitutes roughly 60% of our budget. The concept of integrating congregate care facilities and their patients/residents into community is absolutely the right and equitable goal. The reality is this goal has not been realized, and these facilities have concentrated in a small number of communities, which has created real challenges for the patients and led to even greater hardships for those communities where they have concentrated. Our ask, in addition to having the local oversight to conduct life safety inspections restored, is what all cities of the first class, including Rochester, Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, already have, which is a distancing requirement for any new facilities that they must be 1,320 feet apart. This would not impact any facilities that are currently in place today and would lead to a more equitable distribution of facilities throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Winston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jason Newby, the Inspections and Environmental Health Manager for the City of Brooklyn Park. Prior to 2024, Brooklyn Park and cities across the state had the ability to license and inspect most congregate care homes. The most common type today in the City of Brooklyn Park are assisted living facilities. In 2024, Brooklyn Park and cities across the state were no longer allowed to license and inspect these facilities with six or fewer residents as a rental dwelling. As a result, approximately 290 congregate care facilities with rental licenses were deactivated in 2024, and city inspectors have not been inside these homes since. While some of these facilities were well maintained when we were conducting these inspections, others had significant life safety issues, such as non-functional smoke and carbon monoxide detectors, proper egress in the event of an emergency, unsanitary conditions, and other property maintenance issues related to plumbing, mechanical, electrical, and fire codes. Not having the ability to inspect these facilities on a regular basis creates significant risk for those calling these facilities home. On average, approximately 31% of all rental dwelling inspections in the city, including congregate care facilities in 2022 and 2023, required at least two or more inspections to verify compliance and that all life safety issues were corrected. Just yesterday, one of our inspectors informed me of a concern they received from a resident living in an assisted living facility. Their concerns related to unsanitary conditions and routine maintenance inside the home. They called the city inspector first, mainly because that has been their outlet for many years, and our process requires a 24-hour response and on-site visit. It is our understanding that the state has taken over these inspections. Is the state able to inspect these facilities and respond to complaints at a frequency that protects our residents from life safety issues that we would commonly see when the city had some level of oversight and authority? In closing, all residents in the city have the same right to a healthy, safe, and maintained home. Rental licensure and routine inspections ensures that all residents in the city are afforded the same protections. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newby. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. I'm Police Chief Mark Rulli of Brooklyn Park Police Department.
Good morning. I'm Samantha Brown Hoyt, detective in the Community Health Unit of the Brooklyn Park Police Department, representing the City of Brooklyn Park.
Present your testimony.
Thank you. Compared to other communities in the metro area and statewide, the northwest suburbs have a notably higher concentration of congregate care facilities, which are placing an excessive strain on public safety resources. As Mayor Winston pointed out, congregate care facilities make up 1.7% of all household units in the community, yet account for nearly 1 in 10 of our police and fire calls. On average, mental health calls take 20% longer than the average call to resolve the situation present at these congregate care facilities. This extended response time has contributed to a disproportionate strain on resources, placing an unfair burden on both Brooklyn Park taxpayers and the dedicated staff our police and fire departments.
In 2024, the most common incident types for our police and fire responders going to congregate care facilities included medical emergencies, disturbances, welfare checks, mental health crises, assist calls, phone inquiries, and missing person reports. Beyond the resources allocated to our sworn officers and firemen, we have also deployed two alternative response teams, each consisting of a social worker as well as a medical professional who dedicate many or much of their time in responding to congregate care facilities, most of which do not require police presence on the scene. Over the years, we've also noticed an increase in the number of high-risk Level 3 predatory offenders residing in our city. There are currently 19 Level 3 predatory offenders residing in Brooklyn Park, with 9 of them living in congregate care facilities. In comparison, Bloomington has one Level 3 offender who also resides in a congregate care setting. Maple Grove has 3, 2 of whom reside in congregate care. And Plymouth has no Level 3 offenders. Not only does the density of these congregate care facilities impact the response, it affects the follow-up. In 2024, we made more than 100 MARC reports to the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center and received 605 MARC reports to review and investigate, many of which stem from congregate care facilities. The addition of an average, again, of 50 congregate care facilities annually over the past 5 years is unsustainable. As an agency, we are redirecting police resources to fund social worker positions to address the issues arising at these facilities. We are also concerned that the growing trend is overwhelming our neighborhoods with the constant demand for police, fire, and medical services, hindering efforts to foster vibrant, stable communities.
We propose that the same distance requirements currently in place for licensed congregate care facilities in cities of the first class, such as Duluth, Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul, be applied to any future facilities seeking to relocate in Brooklyn Park or other communities. This would ensure consistency and promote equitable standards for these facilities across the entire state. For those of us in the northwest suburbs, we have some of the largest concentrations of congregate care facilities in the entire state, with some of the most modest tax base and highest public safety needs. We are happy to do our part, but need relief from the concentration that exists today and will get worse unless the state takes action. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League represents the collective interests of our 841 member cities across the state, including both of the cities that you've just heard from. Appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1477. I want to thank Representative Nadeau for chief authoring the bill and continuing to have conversations with both the League and other stakeholders. Of course, I don't think there's anybody in this room that would disagree that group assisted living facilities are a critical component of overall housing stock in communities across the state. But as you've heard, last session, legislation was passed that prohibited all 856 cities from imposing rental licensing requirements on state-licensed group-assisted living facilities licensed under Chapter 144G and 245D with six or fewer residents. And as you've heard, rental licensing adopted via ordinance serves as an important tool to ensure both habitability and livability standards and ensure minimum life safety standards while also holding housing providers accountable to protect both the residents within rental housing and neighbors. Rental licensing also allows cities, through enforcement of property maintenance code that include both the exterior and interior of a property, continue to ensure all housing is decent, safe, and sanitary and is well maintained, with also a mechanism to compel housing providers to fix issues identified by property inspections, or more commonly, as we've heard, issues identified by residents. It's been said, I think, the impetus for the legislation last session that rental licensing is duplicative of the state licensure regime. And while state licensing of group homes is important and, of course, a condition for licensure, rental licensing allows cities to be partners with the Departments of Human Services and the Department of Health, as we are generally able to respond more quickly to address issues and concerns from residents related to livability, safety, and conditions of their housing that may arise throughout the course of the year. Beyond sort of the annual inspection that the agencies have. And so the bill as amended seeks a reasonable balance between city authority to protect individuals with disabilities and group-assisted living facilities, while also expressly calling out in statute that rental licensing can't have the effect of prohibiting group-assisted living facilities. Additionally, as it stands now, there is nothing preventing the clustering of residential programs in most cities in the state, which has impacted certain cities, as you've heard, much more than others. So to be clear, this bill is not intended in any way to prevent group homes, which continues to be a critical part of the housing continuum. It simply introduces back into statute reasonable authorities so that cities can preserve a balance in residential neighborhoods between group-assisted living facilities and all other uses, as well as utilize rental licensing to ensure safe housing for all. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Scott Schulte. I'm the Community Development Director with the City of Champlin. We're a Northwest suburban community, and we appreciate Representative Nadeau's efforts in introducing this and bringing this issue forward for conversation. And we are how this applies to us, I guess, insofar as group assisted living facilities. We're a fairly small community. We have around 40 state-licensed group facilities in the city of Champlin, fairly well dispersed in our community, with one exception. We have a neighborhood in our city that has four state-licensed facilities within I'll call it a half-block area. And that area has gained attention primarily because of calls for service, right? I mean, we've had, in 2024, we had 180 calls for service in this half-a-block area. And we would question and our concern, frankly, for the clients, tenants within those facilities in terms of their well-being in this particular neighborhood. We would, we believe that in this case, over-concentration of group-assisted living facilities make it more difficult for residents to integrate fully with the broader community, with the neighborhood. And we would summarize by saying that while group-assisted living facilities are vital, and they're vital in terms of a support system for these individuals with disabilities and other needs, we would argue that over-concentration in one area can really hinder the social, the economic, the cultural integration of their residents into the wider community. Ideally, these facilities should be spread out across diverse neighborhoods with access to various services and opportunities for integration. And with that, we would request your support of House File 1477. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Sarah Grafstrom. And then we'll continue with Mr. Berg after this. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom, Senior Director of State and Federal Policy with ARM. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to House File 1477. I do want to just start by thanking Representative Nadeau for his willingness to meet with us regarding our concerns about House File 1477 and just say we are all committed to working to make sure people with disabilities are able to live in our communities around the state. By deleting the language on lines 1.9 through 1.11 and 2.12 through 2.15, House File 1477 looks to repeal legislation that was passed last session in a bipartisan manner that removed a city's ability to require a rental license for a 245D licensed community residential setting or a 144G licensed assisted living home, and with the A2 amendment, limit the proximity of assisted living homes in community residential settings. By repealing the language passed last session, we are once again opening the door to a patchwork of city-by-city regulations that can be used to force people with disabilities out of our communities. In cities and counties across the state, group homes operate as valued neighbors and safe settings for people with disabilities. The repeal that is being proposed in House File 1477 and the proximity limitation being proposed in the A2 amendment take us backward, telling people with disabilities that because they live in a group home or assisted living, they are subject to proximity limits that other people are not subject to and could lose their home if the rental license is revoked. We have heard proponents claim to need rental licenses to protect the residents living in the homes, when in fact thorough and extensive licensing regulations within the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health, and the counties are already in place with group homes throughout the state, making them some of the most well-maintained care settings available to Minnesotans who need them. Counties relicense the physical home every other year with a check-in on the off year, and the department licenses the services that are provided in the home. It is the ultimate goal of the state and providers to ensure that people with disabilities are living in the community they choose, with access to the same experiences that everyone has access to. We accomplish this through the federally mandated home and community-based settings rule, which regulates where homes can be located in our communities, ensuring that no home is isolating to the people living there, and people with disabilities are fully integrated into their community. The proximity proposal included in the A2 amendment would go against protections that are currently in place, like the Fair Housing Act, that seeks to ensure that people are not discriminated against in their housing options based on certain characteristics. Our members are committed to working with their local communities to ensure a strong partnership is established between the city and the provider. Ultimately, what we should be focused on is establishing affordable, accessible housing options for people with disabilities across all communities, not putting in place additional barriers to housing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom, for your testimony today. And Mr. Berg on Zoom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just confirming you can hear me.
We can hear you, Mr. Berg. Please introduce yourself for the committee and present your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and I am a leader at a nonprofit affordable, accessible housing provider, an ARM board member, a city council member for the city of Elko Newmarket for the past 10 years, an active member of the League of Minnesota Cities, and a Metro Cities board member since 2021. As both an elected official and a disability service provider, I have a unique perspective of seeing this issue from multiple angles. As many of you know, there are already comprehensive state, county, and fire code oversight mechanisms in place for 245D license settings. We adhere to standards that far exceed what any rental license would require or protect against. Local control in this context does not add value, but rather provides an opportunity for local governments to restrict where individuals with disabilities can live. Many cities explicitly exempt these settings from their rental housing ordinances. In fact, several cities that supported this bill to repeal the bipartisan language passed last session already have exemptions in their current ordinances, including Richfield, Maple Grove, New Brighton, New Hope, St. Anthony, St. Louis Park, Bloomington, and Fridley. Furthermore, the vast majority of cities across the state either do not have rental licensing ordinances or exempt these settings, including cities in each of your districts. The problem is that most cities in Minnesota significantly lack expertise in this area. The only consistency across the 300-plus city ordinances I've reviewed is inconsistency regarding how, when, or if cities write and enforce rental housing ordinances. Additionally, the proposed expansion of the quarter-mile rule beyond first-class cities is not even utilized by our largest cities in the state due to the legal counsel previously stating it would violate fair housing laws. For the past decade, I have worked to remove NIMBY-driven policies that prevent Minnesotans with disabilities from living in their chosen communities. Unfortunately, communities continue to try to use local control tools to promote ageism, ableism, NIMBYism, and discrimination. Whether we at the local level like it or not, we need the state to drive this oversight. If the argument is that the departments overseeing this oversight do not have the resources or processes in place to do so quickly enough for cities, then let's focus our attention on fixing that issue. I'm more than happy to work with the chief author and other supporters to improve this section of law, but this language is not the solution. We have to and can do better. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Is there anyone else who wishes to offer testimony on this? Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair Schumacher and Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Zania Harut, and I'm the board chair of the Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, also known as RPAMN. RPAMN is a small nonprofit trade association that represents small residential assisted living providers and other waiver services providers across Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services already provide comprehensive licensing and oversight for residential assisted livings and community residential service settings, also known as group homes. The state licensing frameworks include rigorous inspections that meet and often exceed the requirements of municipal rental licenses. In addition, cities already have the authority to enforce general public safety ordinances, such as noise and nuisance violations, without needing a separate rental license. At best, a municipal rental license is duplicative of state oversight. At worst, it becomes a tool to block, restrict, or eliminate housing for individuals with disabilities. While state law has prohibited cities from excluding residential settings for people with disabilities through zoning codes since the late 1970s, we have seen cities use rental licensing to sidestep that protection. RPMN has witnessed firsthand the devastating consequences when cities misuse rental licensing authority. In recent years, providers operating in full compliance with state regulations have been abruptly shut down by city councils. These actions force vulnerable adults to relocate suddenly without due process protections provided under Chapter 245D and 144G. These disruptions sever longstanding relationships between residents and their caregivers, jeopardize mental health and physical health, and destabilize the lives already marked by complexity. The risk is even greater for smaller providers who often lease their locations. Until recently, these providers had no flexibility to relocate if they encountered property owner issues. The stakes are too high to allow cities to wield unchecked power over settings that support vulnerable individuals living in residential homes, many of whom have significant behavioral health needs. Simply put, government entities with the appropriate expertise and authority to close licensed residential settings should be DHS and MDH. They understand both the licensing requirements and the complex care needs of residents. Giving cities the ability to override these agencies opens the door to harmful decisions rooted in stigma, misinformation, or political pressure, and not public health or safety. We recognize that House File 1477 is a work in progress. We have deeply appreciated Representative Nadeau's openness and engagement on this issue, especially his willingness to hear directly from providers about real-world implications. That said, we're surprised to see that the A2 amendment includes the 15-day state response language in addition to the municipal license authority rather as an alternative. This is inconsistent with the collaborative intent of our discussions, and we hope to continue refining the language to avoid undermining the very people this system is designed to protect. We know this conversation is not over, and we're committed to working constructively with Representative Nadeau and members of the committee to ensure any final bill prioritizes safety, stability, and dignity for Minnesota's most vulnerable residents.
I also want to note that the reported numbers on license settings may not be entirely accurate. Before the implementation of the assisted living licensure framework, there was no consistent or standardized method to track the total number of licensed residential settings. Additionally, the volume of police calls should not be seen solely as a failure of providers, but rather a call to action. It highlights the urgent need for a preventative and collaborative behavioral health approach, one that brings together cities, providers, and community stakeholders. These challenges point to the fact that the current system is not working as intended, and adding another layer of municipal oversight is unlikely to address the root cause. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony there, and thank you for your comments on that in particular. And as we close public testimony, I guess that's just a chair's prerogative for a moment here on that. The reason that I scheduled a hearing for this bill was because I do believe there are challenges in this area. I am not convinced that this bill is the end-all be-all solution to this, but I know that Representative Nadeau and stakeholders and members of the Senate have been working on this throughout the entire session, and I know this is something I'd like to see some movement on this year in a way that makes sense, but we can't do that if the committee doesn't hear it, and we're running short on time for the ability for the committee to hear things. This committee has always been very thoughtful with the deliberation and the approach to things, and I thought it might be helpful for Representative Nadeau if members were able to hear about this, because otherwise you probably wouldn't be hearing about this. And that was the intent behind all of this as we move forward. And with that, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Nadeau, welcome to our committee today. I'll just start by being completely candid with you. I'm certain that you inadvertently stepped into something that you didn't know about. So for my first question for you is, when did this issue first come to your attention?
Representative Nadeau.
Last summer.
Representative Curran.
Thank you. Chair and committee, please bear with me for a couple of minutes. I've wanted to pass House File 3938, my 2024 legislation to exempt group homes from city rental licenses for over 20 years. I was incredibly lucky to bring that experience to this table in my first term and make good on a long-standing commitment to my friends and my colleagues in the disability community. This was a hard-fought win in a power struggle between people and government, not between city government and state government, people versus government. I've been thinking about this very conversation without knowing who I'd be having it with, since this bill passed last year, when you found out about it. I knew that a repeal effort would be coming, and if not directly in House File 1477, that strikes the exact language I passed, that perhaps glimmers of it might appear in other ways, in other bills, perhaps amended to this one. People have long dealt with government barriers at every level. Although elections give us the title of politician, this issue hits the core of why many of us on both sides of the aisle fought so hard to sit at this table. I cannot in good conscience become part of the very systems that I came here to fight. People versus government, choice versus control, and yes, even people versus local control. At the end of the day, cities are government, and we could go back and forth and get pretty intense about this bill. I'd say things that some cities wouldn't like. You'd say things that the disability community doesn't like. The end result would still be the same. We'd still be laying the bill over. And in the meantime, we would take up a whole lot of time in a mutually harmful discussion. I would love for us as a committee not to go down that road. And having heard testimony from both sides, considering the task ahead of us, chairs, as we have to accomplish a difficult budget together, I would encourage this committee to lay the bill over without fighting it out. Representative Nadeau, might you take me up on this offer to proceed without a lengthy debate before we lay it over?
Sure. Representative Nadeau.
Absolutely.
Okay, Representative Curran.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
I know you're all shocked. Do you know what So this isn't actually a question, it's a statement. So downstairs right now in the basement, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities has a wonderful show of the history of people with developmental disabilities in the state of Minnesota. They've got all the plaques up. It's great. And there's a lot of great history. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it, I'd really encourage everyone to. The last person with a developmental disability was discharged from the state hospitals in Minnesota in 1997. I'm fairly confident everyone sitting around this table, except for maybe Megan, was born. 1997. That was when we told people with developmental disabilities who have IQs under 70 that we would let them out of a hospital and let them live in the community. That's when the last person was discharged in Minnesota. And in 1999, I was working at a group home in Rochester with four young men who all had developmental disabilities. Cerebral palsy. One individual was deaf and blind, another individual had a neurological condition, and another individual had spina bifida. And I was 16. And it was a beautiful home. It was a slab on grade, completely accessible home. And I was so excited to work there. And I was at work, and my supervisor came in and said some words that were not super great. They were maybe a little colorful. Oh. And I said, what in goodness gracious? And I said, we have to go have another community conversation about this house. And I said, what are you talking about? They don't want a group home here. I said, what do you mean? These guys are between the ages of 16 and 21. They're all in wheelchairs. What do you mean they don't want a group home here? And they said, they don't want a group home here. They're afraid they're going to hurt their children. I said, what do they think they're going to do? Run them over with their wheelchair? But that happened in 1999 to 16-year-old me. And I caution you all that opening this up is saying that people with disabilities don't deserve to live in your community because sometimes they fall out of their wheelchair and they have to call 911. Because sometimes they have autism and they get overstimulated and they maybe get a little loud and maybe they have a mental health crisis and they need to be taken to the hospital. Because sometimes the only place we can find that has a slab on grade accessible housing might be three in one city or three in one neighborhood. We're not trying to take over your communities. We're just trying to be a part of it. And I beg of you, please, hear me when I say many times these ideas come from good places, but what they do is they tell people with disabilities and their parents and their grandmas and their aunties and their uncles that we appreciate you and we like you as long as you're not here.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Final word, Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. This is a work in progress, and I will continue to work, hopefully in good faith. There's no one here that it has a stronger belief in the validity and importance of making sure that people with disabilities live in community, and if I thought this was going to harm that, I would drop it in a heartbeat. However, our job is to try to find that balance, and so that's what I will continue to try to work on, and I appreciate the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, House File 1477, as amended, is laid over. Members, please hold on to House File 2040. We're hoping that next Wednesday we'll get that one filled in. Thank you for your indulgence and the extra time this morning. Representative Knorr, anything for next week?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have got a robust agenda items next week, so hopefully we'll see you at 8:15 on Tuesday.
We'll get to see you at 8:15 next Tuesday for robust conversations. With that, we are adjourned.